Welcome to Solidarity Not Charity here on uhururadio.com. Today is Sunday. We're doing the live broadcast of the Solidarity program here on uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. And Solidarity Not Charity, as you may know, is the program coordinated by the African People's Solidarity Committee that was organized by the African People's Socialist Party to work in the white communities and build solidarity from the white community with the struggle for African liberation, for the return of Africa's resources to African people. And we're honored to have this opportunity and grateful to the African People's Socialist Party for establishing the African People's Solidarity Committee and for giving us this time here on uhururadio.com each week to talk with you about what we can do to build support and solidarity and take a stand on the right side of the future, on the right side of history, and to play our role in solidarity with the right of African people to be a free and self-determining people. You've just been listening to a replay of Uhuru on the Move. Here is on the day after we concluded the annual fund drive here on uhururadio.com. The main broadcast computer that Uhuru Radio broadcasts on went on the blink, and so there's been some workarounds taking place earlier in the day, because you heard a replay of Africa Live where normally you would hear a live show there. The replay that you just heard of Uhuru on the Move will be a recurring a replay that you will hear at 1 o'clock on Sundays, because Uhuru on the Move has moved to Monday evenings. You can tune in for the live broadcast tomorrow night of Uhuru on the Move. But the replay that we were hearing was an excellent interview that took place last week. And just at the end of that interview, if you were listening, you heard a plug for an event that is going on today. And so we just want to make sure that any of our listeners who are in the Houston area, in Houston, Texas, take this opportunity today to go and hear African People's Socialist Party Omalie Chitela speaking at the SHAPE Community Center at 3815 Live Oak in Houston, Texas. He will be speaking there. There's a program from 6 to 9:45 p.m. today. That's at the SHAPE Community Center at 3515 Live Oak in Houston, Texas. I think that's in the third ward of Houston. And if you have questions or need more information, you can email houston@uhurutours.com, or you can call 281-386-6442. That's 281-386-6442. And that should be a really dynamic, really exciting program. So don't miss that if you're in the Houston area. And hopefully on Omalie Chitela Speaks next week here on Uhuru Radio, we'll be able to have the play you a recording of his presentation. If you're not in the Houston area, as I am not, and not able to attend that event, hopefully we'll get to hear that on Uhuru Radio next week. So today on Solidarity Not Charity, we had advertised that we would do highlights from last week's African People's Solidarity Day that took place here in St. Petersburg, Florida. And as we began to review those tapes and those highlights from that very exciting, very excellent event, Began by listening to the presentation that was made by Chioma Oru, who is the leader of the North American Regional Organization of the African Socialist International. She's a postgraduate student at Howard, focusing on the area of AFRICOM, studies of AFRICOM and NORCOM, the U.S. military presence in Africa and in the African community, both on the continent of Africa and within the borders of the U.S. And that was such an excellent presentation. We said, we can't cut any of this. We are going to air it in its entirety. And in future programs, we'll try to bring you some other highlights from last Sunday's African People's Solidarity Day that took place October 11th here in St. Petersburg, Florida. So I'm going to play for you now the presentation made by Chioma Oru. And this is that was titled Militarism in the Era of Obama, in the Age of Obama. A really informative presentation, and I know you'll get a lot out of it. So here she is, Chioma Oru.
Yet a third, it's a strategy of colonialism. It's the reality of colonialism. It's how colonialism actualizes itself in our world, in our lives. So it's through militarism that I got to see things more clearly, and it's through militarism that I got to understand Obama. Like, it's only opportunism, which is another ism here, that would allow for people to see who Obama was and understand the things that I was exposed to as a novice in research and not understand who he represents at this juncture. It's the only opportunism that lets that happen. So I want to take down a walk down philosophy lane here, set up theoretically around the questions of, that we're talking about here, which is militarism in this age of Obama. You know, there and this being African People's Solidarity Day, usually I shy away from talking about, white scholars. You know, it's just that thing the chairman was saying. You tell me you wear my hat one side, I'm going to wear it the other. You know, I'm going to find some African that said it first. But today I think it is important, scientifically, to highlight some white people that have theoretically set an understanding, of course, with contradiction. We have Hobson, J. Hobson, who in the early 1900s, I'll get into him, develops a theory around imperialism. We have Rosa Luxemburg from Russia, who really set forward and was part of the understanding of dependency theory. We have, of course, coming to the African side, we have neocolonialism as understood by Kwame Nkrumah, and we have African internationalism as understood by our chairman, Omali Yeshitela. So imperialism, as Hobson has put it, is in around 1902, he published a theory around the preempted development of multinational corporations. It's in his works that we began to understand what consumption and underconsumption was. In his way of understanding imperialism from his interest as a white nationalist of England, he thought that the question of underconsumption, and it's a question of, in his time, and mind you, economically, it was trumped, that underconsumption was a flawed theory, and even as he put it, as we see, as it manifests today, in that he warned that monopoly of production and elimination of competition leads to more products than a society, the nation state of England could handle, and therefore that it would lead to expansionism and the corporations of England having their interest outside of the nation, and that the state of England would have to protect those interests even though they weren't directly feeding the people. Now, he also pioneered, he was a liberal theorist, and there's so many things wrong with liberal philosophy, but economic liberalism is the worst kind because he promoted British domination of wealth. So his whole theoretical frame and understanding of imperialism was around the question of how England can continue to dominate the world and still serve its people. So China, play both sides of the fence. You can't feed your poor and screw over the world at the same time. This is what he misunderstood. Independency. Now, Rosa Luxemburg, who, you know, did a lot of study on capitalism. She was a Marxist scholar. And she says, I quote here, that capitalism must always and everywhere fight a battle of annihilation against historical forms of national economy that it encounters. The principal method in the struggle are political force, war, as we know, militarism, oppressive taxation by the state, which is what Hobson recommended as a solution, was that taxation should amend for anything that overconsumption, as he put it, would do, and so that corporations could stay loyal to the supposed people of England. But she says that it's an oppressive form just by the nature of capitalism and the cheap goods. Now, dependency theory generally is understood about how it's the white man's burden, so to speak, how African people are dependent on European structures. But what I like about Rosa Luxemburg is that she understood that the true dependency was capitalism fighting for its life at every juncture. She understood that in order for capitalism to survive, we need war. In order for it to live, you need terror. You know, you need all these, you need cheap goods. And it's on cheap goods that if we want to get into multinational corporations, that's on the premise in which they exist in the world. Now, neocolonialism, as understood by Kwame Nkrumah, you know, he states, and this is it's a long quote, I hope you take the time to read it. I'll read just some parts of it. He says that in order to halt foreign interference in the affairs, again, this propagation of, you know, the needing, the addiction, the dependency on cheap goods and production of cheap goods to sustain a life, the overconsumption of an existence, as Hobson had put it, in the affairs of developing countries, is necessary to study, understand, and expose active combat neocolonialism and whatever it gives in whatever guise it may appear. The section of this that I think is most critical is that he says, under cover of such phrases, however, it devises innumerable ways to accomplish objectives formally achieved by naked colonialism. It is this sum of total of the modern attempts to perpetuate colonialism while at the same time talking about freedom, which has come, it's probably easier for me to read it here than on there. Under such cover of phrases, however, it devises innumerable ways to accomplish objectives formerly achieved by naked colonialism. It is the sum total of these modern attempts to perpetuate colonialism while at the same time talking about freedom, which has come to be known as neocolonialism. So, you know, the whole concept of neocolonialism, and he doesn't limit it to what we understand as white power and black face. He also understood the existence of the United States, period, as a neocolonial force. This hoax of freedom and liberty and, you know, all the stuff that John Locke will talk about, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all of that crap, like all that, he exposed that in a very succinct and tight way. And of course, that came with predictions. Now we look at African internationalism, which takes a very specific angle on neocolonialism, which is that African internationalism, it quotes here, recognizes the existence of class and the fact that neocolonialists must be overthrown. It goes on to say that the African petty bourgeoisie, being the neocolonial force, being the element that we're studying right now, that we're looking at a phenomena of Barack Obama, falling into this segment of the population of neocolonialists called the African petty bourgeoisie, has taken a stake in African continuing to exist more or less as it does today. It's bought into that which Kwame Nkrumah had warned against, which is that hoax, that thing that freedom has come. I'm talking about our flag independence and our supposed liberties, and they know better. Like I said, if I know better, and I've only been researching for 2 years, people who've been going at this for many years, they know better too, but their interests are tied into other things. And we say that there are billions of African people, you know, that the African petty bourgeoisie seeks to manipulate. Now, I want to get into the dialectics of Yeshitelism, which is, you know, African internationalism by another name. And it's based on philosophical materialism, which is as opposed to Hegel's philosophical idealism, and I'm not going to get into throughout too many languages. I just want to get to the crux of things, that dialectics in sum is the study of change. In African internationalist dialectics is the study of change, the political economy from the point of view, as I understand it, the wretched of the earth, the African working class and poor peasants. And part of the study involves understanding the state, its strategies, which are counterinsurgency, which is where this military question comes in, its adversaries, insurgents, the African working class and poor peasants, Afghanistan people, as the chairman had mentioned, the fighting working class people in Iraq. All around this world, we see people rising up. And it is in this response, and what must be done is that the position of the African working class in this dialectic, in this change, it's going to happen. And we have to get on the right side to really lead it in the best way for all of us to benefit. So I just want to point out some tenets to African internationalism. Capitalism is parasitic and imperialistic. I don't think I need to go into too much explanation on that. The primitive accumulation or the startup money of imperialism came from the transatlantic slave trade, colonialism, neocolonialism. We've gone through some of this earlier in Comrade Penny's presentation and in the chairman's presentation, so I won't belabor the points. Imperialism is the material basis for white nationalism. That liberal white left politics is a product of white nationalism and seeks to reform the system, not to overturn it. The only way to overturn this system is through revolutionary anti-colonial struggle. It's the only way. I say this for the Africans in the room. If you think you can find a way around it, you're sadly mistaken. It's liberal and it's not going to get us free. And also for the white people in the room, be clear on that same question. It's liberal and it won't get you free either. So African workers inside the U.S. are neocolonial subjects and must join in the worldwide African international struggle. This revolution can only be carried out by the vanguard of the African working class, and that is the advanced detachment, and that is those of us that are committed. You know, they got nothing to gain but our freedom and the freedom of our people, and I especially like that point. The formation of the African People's Socialist African People's Solidarity Committee as a strategy to combat opportunism as displayed in the liberal white left. Now, you know, this is why we're here. Solidarity, not charity, right? That it's a brilliant strategy that our chairman O'Malley Ashitella understood was objective, because what I see, at least in my lifetime, that so many Africans opportunistically will ostracize white people's involvement in the struggle for their own interest of keeping the working class African people at bay. So there's always that playing on the illusion of racism instead of cutting at the point of our freedom. That all of us have nothing to gain but that. So from theory to practice, how do some of these theories, from imperialism as Hobson to dependency as Luxembourg and neocolonialism and Nkrumah and African internationalism, as Yeshitela has explained, how do these manifest in the real world? And how they do at this time is through privatization and globalization. We see that clearly as an imperialist agenda. Militarism as the strategy of dependency. White power and blackface is neocolonialism in its most vulgar example. And the crisis of imperialism as the basis as to why the African internationalist prediction puts forward what it does. So privatization, we'll take it one at a time, privatization and globalization. Privatization is capitalism on crack, and no pun intended, the war on drugs and all of that. Yes, that is all capitalism. It is a con game where public health is given to private multinational corporations not bound to the will of the people. You know, we see that is exactly what Hobson kind of, you know, he was thinking about his interests as a white nationalist, but he outlined that when you see privatization happening, that public funds is going to have to go into protecting it. There's no such thing as privatization. It's just in whose interest is it working towards? And we'll see that more clearly as we understand the military question. And globalization is colonialism on steroids, if we're going to go on analogies. It's often mistaken as a consequence of weak states, which is a huge mistake. It is actually a vulgar example of what Hobson warned as the strong state intervening on behalf of private companies. So at no point in history have we seen where a private company just went in on its own. It was always connected to a state. It was always connected to a national identity. It still is. Even though these national identities are illusions and delusions, and they're, you know, perpetuating the interest of the ruling class, the global ruling class, the international ruling class, that they see no borders, but they have states. And those states are in the form of armies. And they protect them. And you come out of here and do something that that you think in your freedom and in your liberties is in your right to do. And the state will show you that it's not, if it's not in their interest, right? Even if you are a business holder, owner, or whoever, you know, you got to show your credentials before they protect you. We see that that is what privatization and globalization is all about. And militarism, which is really the nexus of this presentation, is the offensive and defensive response to resistance, which is the natural response to imperialism and the natural response to neocolonialism. And it is what African internationalism predicts, that resistance, but it predicts that it has to be led to be effective and for freedom to actually happen by the African working class and poor peasants. And we see that it's a $1 billion industry. We'll get into details on that. And the military-industrial complex, and it was really termed and coined as a word by President Eisenhower as he was leaving office, but its conceptualization came from Hobson and his, you know, philosophical soulmate, Keynes, justifies itself by becoming a permanent feature in society, and private citizens are tasked by public wars, and public wars are funded by private industry. It's again the it exposes the lie of privatization. The military question does. I mean, we can go into details of, you know, economic liberalism and liberalization, but one thing that you can never argue is that war, the question of war, is this vicious cycle, time and again, where you have public interests that are funding your tax dollars, your earned income, and your abilities to articulate where your earned income goes is circumvented by a government, a state that protects the interests of public wars. And they use, and then they give military contracts to private corporations, and it's the same vicious story. And Luxembourg, she understands that understands militarism as capitalism's way to blow off steam. You know, that it's its way to survive. Really, it's how it doesn't internally combust, and therefore is indispensable to imperialism. For imperialism to survive, militarism has to be alive. It has to be a strategy implemented. It is distinct from militias and resistance and insurgencies, even though we see, you know, like one thing, the argument, the liberal talk, you know, of nonviolence and this whole nonsensical conversation on the question, it's not the same thing. We're not talking about a people rising up and taking arms that are produced on the world arms market. I mean, you're going to have to find, even if you picked up a brick, somebody produced that brick, some industry did it, but it's a strategy that you use to defend yourself, which is completely different for militarism as an agenda. It's a different engine. White power in blackface. So we look that since the 1970s, there have been an exponential account of elected black officials, which seems like a good thing, right, in the U.S. And we see an increase of over 10,000 in 2009 and growing. And this is propagated in the world as a success. But really, it's a strategy. It's a strategy of militarism. It's a strategy to pull one over so that it can at least delay when imperialism has to blow off steam again. Because, you know, it really doesn't want to blow off steam if it doesn't have to. I mean, I think they want peace as much as anyone preaches, the chairman says. They benefit from it, but they also benefit from your loyalty. So neocolonialism is that strategy that they need to keep fighting who they want to fight on their terms, not who we want to fight on our terms as working class people. So we see that Washington, D.C., where I reside, where I live, where I work, where I breathe, and where I struggle, it houses the most affluent and educated population of black people. It is a nest for neocolonialism. And that was very interesting to come across, that there are superstars of black power, white power, and blackface. You know, if you need to put a face to it, besides Barack Obama, we have our Oprah Winfrey's, Colin Powell's, Clarence Thomas, Kip Ward, who heads up AFRICOM, Condoleezza Rice, the whole Congressional Black Caucus, the 54 presidents of the African nation, and of course, our subject of interest, Barack Hussein Obama. And neocolonialism is the worst. This is a quote from Nkrumah. Is the worst of all imperialism. For those who practice it, it means without responsibility. And for those who suffer from it, it means exploitation without redress. And the crisis of imperialism. And this is a quote. That the world's capitalist system is suffering an earth-shaking economic crisis of historic proportions. Ripe recipe to carry out our revolutionary mandate. That while imperialism is catching heat, let's give them hell. And the rise in economic powerhouses coming from a piece of the imperialist pie. This is a sharing of power. Part of what has put imperialism at a crisis is that now it has to share more. It's, you know, I like the example of siblings, you know, like you got a child and then, you know, other children start coming in and have to share all the attention that you used to get. And imperialism is a big baby, so it's a perfect example. The way we see that now where it was the G7 and then the G8 and now is the G20, and these are all the countries that are of the G20, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Italy, Japan, Mexico, Russia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, South Korea, Turkey, United Kingdom, and the United States. These are all who make up the G20. You know, as we see Argentina, which is in Latin America. We see South Africa, which is in Africa. You know, we see Mexico. We see these emerging powers that are coming for the same pie that these imperialist countries have enjoyed for far too long in isolation. And they don't like it. And of course, the strategy that they, you know, implement even for their new friends is to blow off steam when necessary. This is what the world wars have shown, that imperialism has no permanent friends and it needs to blow off steam to live, to survive. It's very objective about its interests. So consolidation of power through the nation state and financial institutions. Now, you know, I'm not going to go too much into this because I understand, too, that Comrade Penny put it really nicely. You know, like, there, I want to really be without going into too much detail of the history that's already been provided for us, is more focus on the relationship between the nation state and these financial institutions as they are. So I want to look at some history here, and a couple of them are the treaties of Oswald in 1555 and the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, the Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885, the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF, World Bank, and the UN that set those up after World War II in about 1945, NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, and NATO, which is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and the Unified Command Plan, of which, you know, was my point of entry in understanding some of these things, is NORTHCOM, AFRICOM, CENTCOM, PACCOM, and EUCOM. And lastly, the G20, of which these consolidated forces, the US, the UK, EU, and AU, which is African Union, European Union, United Kingdom, and US. Now, before I start sounding like I'm talking Japanese, I do want to say a few things, though, that, you know, part of the necessity to go into this history is because the surface is AFRICOM. The surface is NORTHCOM. The surface is all the things that we understand. To dig deeper, that this thing has been in works for a long time. This is a well thought out plan. You know, and these people have implemented these programs. They come in the form of policy. They come, you know, they have their philosophical roots, but they have their real practical documented strategies in which they implement on a daily basis. And today we're making new history. There are treaties and policies being signed today that somebody is going to talk about in a few years, and hopefully from the perspective of a people who won a revolution and talked about what happened way back when. But this is the reality of us. The Treaty of Oswald, in brief, it implemented the strategy when opposing forms of the ruling class wanted to fight over religion. In some, the only benefit in its place in history, in its place in this relationship, in solidifying this relationship of what is militarism, what is the military-industrial complex, is it gave a point of sovereignty. It was at this juncture that European states began understanding the necessity for sovereignty, that the relationship between ruling classes or different segments of the ruling class, that one population can say that I can be Protestant or I can be Catholic, but I get to say what my people the people that are under my leadership practice, and the independence to make those kind of decisions based on, you know, your standard, your place within who you were related to and who you were ruling. And this came at the fall of, these are all descendants, it's a Germanic, this is in Germany, Ostfog is a place in Germany, and Westphalia as well was an agreement that followed Ostfog that says that it was the creation of the modern nation state. Most of the countries we see today, England, France, Germany, Italy, you know, the European Union period, all of them found their life, found their name, found their territory, all the things that makes a nation and subsequently a state, came as a result of this Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. And also I thought what was notable to recognize, which was not a treaty, but it was an occurrence, was the Glorious Revolution, which was, again, not only it solidified, it happened in the same period, where as the nation states were finding their sovereignty and finding the rules of the game to navigate in which we see happening, they also found the economic footing to really give it its drive. And in this so-called Glorious Revolution, the Bloodless Revolution, which marked the end of the Royal African Company and really entered, brought us into the industrial age, the Industrial Revolution, you know, opened up the free trade for the slave market. And I think it's in the same period that Penny had mentioned, I forget the name of what the stock market, the beginning of the stock market. Amsterdam, exactly. It's in this period that we see that emerging as well. So the Berlin Conference of 1884 and 1885, this is really specific to the African continent. And really, it had implications for other oppressed areas, Latin America and in Asia and the latter. And is that it suggested by Portugal, who was losing power in because of slavery, it was losing money, it didn't have territories, and they started the whole slave trade in the 1400s, you know, with their navy and their army. It all started as a military question, as a strategy for Europeans to stop fighting over Africa. Because again, now that you had these nation states, and it's at this point that Hobson's life and his works come into reality, because he predicted this. He predicted that this would happen, well, it happened before his time, but he predicted where this was going, which was that European nations, in order for them to not fight over territories, they had to come up with new systems. You know, so they had these nation states to stop one war, which was fighting over religion and territory and sovereignty, who gets to live. And then they had another struggle over who controls the market, which is the slave market, you know, and they needed a liberalization of that into the free market economy. But then they also had, you know, the primitive accumulation, you know, their startup money, which is that, which was Africa, which was Asia as well, and the resources of the planet that most of Europe, that the Treaty of Westphalia covered, had no right or jurisdiction over. And so to stop fighting, there was lots of wars going on. Sudan, if you follow the history of Sudan, the battle there really, really sparked this Berlin Conference and Portugal's attempt to try and subdue a lot of the conflicts happening in Sudan, in Egypt, in West Africa, in Southern Africa, all over the place. Europeans were fighting each other. Germany, when the Ottoman van Bismarck, and the rise of that empire as a force in that era, they all sat down together and they divided Africa's territories in this conference of the Berlin. And some of the agreements that they came up with is that Congo would become the personal property of King Leopold, assigned prohibition of the slave trade and the forced division of African territories amongst, you know, as what we see now, the modern nation states of the African continent, from Nigeria to Congo, which is kind of still the personal property of Belgium in some ways, and France and U.S. It's kind of a big pie. So any of the nation states, to Egypt, to Sudan, you name it, South Africa, all of these countries got their territorial root at this era, at this period. And it's, again, military that allowed for that to happen. The separation of these states could only happen, could only enforce itself through military might. That all these treaties, Ostfog as a consequence of war, Westphalia as a consequence of war, Berlin Conference as a consequence of war, and a perpetuation of war, because, again, imperialism always needs to blow off steam. So the Bretton Woods institutions, which are violent in their own ways, that may not mirror war as we understand militarism, but they fund them. They help fund this industrial complex of military, of militarism, of fighting, of blowing off steam. So we see in 1944, at the end of World War II, through the framework of the International Economic Order, imperialist powers of the world established the Bretton Woods. Bretton Woods is a town in New Hampshire, and they got together, and it was based that it's this time that they created the International Monetary Fund. They created the International Banking for Reconstruction and Development, also known as the World Bank, or later known as the World Bank. And the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, replaced by the World Trade Organization, the WTO, and then also the creation of the United Nations. These are all strategies. So we see, just again, taken from the evolution of the nation state, the European nation state, protecting the interests of the European working class, moving then into the creation of protecting their interest on the African continent, primarily because, again, majority of the Earth's resources are on the African continent. Gold, magnesium, copper, coltan, cobalt, oil, water, you name it, Africa's got it. They needed to protect their interests by creating those states that were under their direct control that we understand as colonialism. But then they took it one step further because the game had to change. You know, we had World War I, which was, you know, an explosive war, of which Lenin arose and, you know, established a new, different world order in which communism, you know, perpetuated, which was liberal in some ways, even though he probably would never call it liberal, in that it also justified, you know, oppression on some degrees in how it moved in the world, maybe not in theory, but definitely in practice. And we see that by World War II, the U.S. had positioned itself strategically to be the leading imperialist structure, which is why this would happen in the U.S., not Germany, because mind you, most of the other conferences I just mentioned, most of the other treaties happen in Germany, from Oslo to Westphalia to Berlin, were all Germany. These are all segments of the Roman Empire. But then we move into a time and a shift in power where the U.S. was emerging as a world force to be reckoned with, imperialism defining itself in a new way. And it's through these institutions. And the United Nations, again, recognize the United Nations is not shy about recognizing that how it moves, how it recognizes a state, is from the Treaty of Westphalia. Their allegiance is to that, you know, historical root. You know, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, but to me it's pretty offensive that would be the history that leads to the oppression of the world and the human rights statute and all the crazy stuff that they talk about, the liberal talk that they give, is rooted in the oppression of African people and other colonized and oppressed people that's perpetuated on this military question time and again. So we also see the emergence of the North Atlantic Trade Organization, which emerged at the same time. It emerged as a broker between the U.S. and Europe to safeguard U.S. and European Union's, well, at this point it's the European Union, but it was the unofficial European Union, the trade agreements that they had with each other and the security interests. It was at that point that we saw, you know, the Marshall Plan and things of that nature, and in which the U.S. offered economic assistance and military assistance to rebuild Europe after World War II. Since September 11th, however, NATO has deployed, it should say, about 68,000 troops to Iraq and Afghanistan. And counting. And NATO is responsible for over 70% of the international defense spending worldwide. So when we talk about the military-industrial complex, the illusion of the nation state is that, again, we see it as they want us to see it, that, yes, there is a U.S., yes, there is an EU and England and these countries, and there are these fake countries in Africa and in Latin America and in Asia, but we also have these institutions that are global, that are private to some degree, that receive their lifeline by private institutions, and receives 70% of the world's international defense spending. And along with the UN Security Council, NATO has approved, okay, this was at 68,000 of international security assistance forces to intervene in Afghanistan by 2010. And this is on top of the numbers that have already been in Afghanistan. And just lastly, I want to talk about the North American Free Trade Agreement. We see that in 1994, there was a trilateral agreement between, again, these states of U.S., Canada, and Mexico to eliminate the tariffs of goods in America. Now, even though this is economic liberalization, we know clearly it's in our lifetime that NAFTA could only exist through military occupation, that they're patrolling those borders, that let a Mexican try and come into the U.S. Based on all the consequences of NAFTA, and they'll be greeted by the Minutemen there at the border and everyone else. You know, we see North America, even on a Canadian border, it's getting pretty hot, as I'm learning to understand. And we see that in trade, that this meant privatization. And the consequences of this is that in industry, it meant outsourcing and emigration. So U.S. was again, what Hobson had predicted for England became true to the U.S., where they had produced too much. There was too much monopoly going on in the U.S., so they sent it out, and they had to, you know, find a market. They had to create a market while also creating an industry abroad. And emigration, people needing to come to the U.S. because this is where the money was being spent. Their resources were robbed, and we see that not just from Mexico. The question of the immigration question that I think is always skewed is it's focused, and you know, to some degrees, rightfully so, around Mexico and South and Central America. But this immigration phenomenon created by NAFTA and NATO were also affected the African world. You saw droves of Africans. You still see droves of Africans. You go, you know, as the chairman has noted, you see on an African continent, you go to any embassy, U.S. embassy, you got lines for days, you know, around. People are trying to get out because the resources aren't there. You know, there's overconsumption here, and they're trying to come here to get the $6 billion, or, you know, the resources that are theirs here. You know, you have a small population, the world's population here in the United States, over consuming things and have no real way to sustain that through industry, through work, through labor. So they bring in, and emigration leads to that. In the environment, and they have to have a military way to check and regulate how that actually moves. So in environment, this meant toxicity and unregulated emissions of greenhouse gases. So, you know, whereas U.S. may not be able to get away with, you know, pipelines in the U.S., whether in Alaska or in Texas or whatever, they can do it in Afghanistan, they can do it in the Niger Delta, they can do it in places that they are completely unregulated. You know, and we see that this again, NAFTA, even though it's the North American Free Trade Agreement, you know, this is what globalization is. Everyone has to, you know, suffer the piece of U.S.'s initiated projects and programs that may seem, you know, regional, but, you know, are clearly international. In agriculture, this meant over and under consumption that leads to subsidization. And this also is part of why Africans are trying to emigrate here, are trying to get away from the wars in the Congo, are trying to get away from what's going on in Somalia and Sudan and anywhere else, is because the U.S. is also, not only are they attacking them with a military strategy, the other offensive that is violent is subsidization, where U.S. cotton growers are given money to keep growing cotton, and at the same time, cotton growers in Benin can't find a market for their cotton. Where's the free trade in that question? And so then they're here, they're coming, and it's through NAFTA. They say they protect Mexican growers as well, but I've never seen that happen. And the end result of that is oppression. You know, it's the end day. You know, we see what's happening in Colombia through Coca-Cola. That's a piece of irony on that. But to get into the crux of the Unified Command Plan. Now, all of these that I just laid out, these treaties, these policies, these agreements, these things that imperialism does, these strategies imperialism uses to fight for its life, the most vulgar, easy way to understand it is through the Unified Command Plan that emerged about the same time as the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF, the World Bank, and the latter. And this, again, World War II, you know, I think there hasn't been enough study on World War II, you know, and what happened in that era, where the world shifted at that point. It upped the ante, and imperialism, again, to not internally combust, you know, had to find a way to survive. And so the United States emerging as this political power and military power established systematically since 1945, over 1,000 military facilities around the world. And we see them, the first being the EUCOM, the European Command, the next being, I forget the order it is, but I think it's PACCOM, the Pacific Command in Asia, CENTCOM, the Central Command in the U.S., SOUTHCOM in South and Central America, NORTHCOM, which is right here in North America. And mind you, of these military facilities, you know, the majority of them are here. You know, PACCOM's home is here. I think it's in Florida. CENTCOM is in Florida. And we have, you know, the emergence of the latest one is the U.S. AFRICOM. You know, and AFRICOM is a stamp and a seal. As World War II was a marker in history, we are living in another strong marker, which is why, you know, I titled this Militarism in the Age of Obama. We're going to be talking about the age of Obama. It is so significant. If we are doing our duty, if we are, you know, following the change and letting our understandings, you know, objectively move us to action, we will see that at this juncture, we have no choice. They have given us no choice but to respond to these tactics. And they predicted that every strategy they do, every treaty they do, every thing that they sign is to stop resistance. Maybe I didn't state that before. From Oswald to Westphalia to the Bretton Woods, these are all strategies to stop a people from resisting and fighting for their freedom. So we see that again, the natural response that Hobson would argue of public funds used to fund private wars will be resistance. You know, it will be a threat to the state that he loved to protect. And right now, we see a defense budget of $663.8 billion for the Department of Defense in an economic crisis. I mean, it's a recipe for resistance. I mean, if this won't make us resist, I don't know what will. And again, this is an African problem. This is a white people problem. This is everybody's problem. And we also see that in this era, we have $55.1 billion because what also happened prior to Obama coming into power was the separation from the Homeland Security and making it distinct from the Department of Defense, and in which used to be the National Security Agency, and it still functions in that way. But it has its own independent budget, which is in the billions as well. And these are the numbers that we know. You know, there's so much that goes un... they say they publish everything, but they hide it on their websites. You know, what is being spent and how it's being spent. So I don't want to spend too much time on the G20 besides pointing out that we see, again, the resistance is happening. Resistance is happening no matter what's happening in this room, no matter what we think when we see. You know, somebody said if you think you're bored, you're not paying attention. You know, there's too much happening at this point. You know, this is a hot time for all people. But imperialism is also recognizing the heat of the era, and it's blowing off steam again, and we're going to see it more and more and more. I mean, AFRICOM really set that in place. NORTHCOM, which also deployed troops, set that in place. Mind you, majority of the people in Iraq and Afghanistan, over 30% of the troops that come back damaged. They come back not able to function. You know, they've been so screwed up by what they've been exposed to. And these same people are the ones that have been put in Fort Stewart, Georgia, to now act as second response to the police departments through Northern Command in our communities all around here. And it was through that we see all this police that showed up in Pittsburgh to protect. Again, everything that they do is to make sure the resistance doesn't actually happen, that they're calculating war, that war has to profit them, not break and kill them, right? So when they get to respond, there were over 200 people arrested, over at least one dead, pending criminal charges for using Twitter. I mean, but at least we have Obama as a Nobel Peace Prize. I think the only thing about this whole Nobel Peace Prize that I want to point out is that Nobel was, you know, the whole thing is just ridiculous. From Nobel to Obama, it just doesn't make any sense. You know, but one thing I do like is that the head of the Nobel Committee, I can't say his name, Torbjörn Jagland. He says that we would like to support what Obama is trying to achieve. And I think that's the most honest statement anyone has made about this whole Nobel Prize ridiculous phenomenon, you know, that they really do. They really do want to support what he's trying to achieve. And what is he trying to achieve? We see he's trying to achieve the war economy that he's created. The global war on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq, these are moneymakers. You know, I want to say one thing about Afghanistan, that Afghanistan is in the middle of the desert. You know, they can't really grow food that is exportable in any case, or even to support the economy. And there aren't a whole lot of natural resources there. So what does the U.S. benefit from Afghanistan? One, the largest arms market in the world is in Pakistan, right next to Afghanistan. And of course, Iran is there too, on the other side of it, with nuclear weapons. We also see that Afghanistan has pipelines, you know, oil pipelines. But most importantly, and I think the chairman put it out, that the people in Afghanistan are giving them hell. No one has been able to defeat the people of Afghanistan. From the British in the 1800s to try to, their armies got eliminated and exterminated there, you know, to Russia, you know, to the U.S., you know, we see it, that these people are fighting people. I mean, they come up training. They're born with a gun in their hands, you know, and you can't defeat a people like that. You can't. Call it nationalism, call it whatever you want. You're not going to defeat these people. And Iraq, to some degrees, you know, Iraq, of course, is much more clear. It's about all about oil. You know, there's ego involved in it. George Bush was fighting his daddy's war. But Barack Obama is really objective about why he's still in Iraq. He's there for interest. They have a large military facility there. They have Halliburton contracts to protect. They have Z or Blackwater contracts to protect. They got money. They got money tied into Iraq and oil. And Diego Garcia. We're going to talk about Diego Garcia, which is a little island off the coast of, it's in the Indian Ocean in between Asia and Africa, and the large military naval facility there. And the world industry, the world of industrial complexes. You know, one of the things that Obama, you know, why they support him is that he's a face. You know, he's a face for imperialism. He's a face to cover up, you know, all the things, these interests, these treaties had formed. You know, what they really, really have been, they have been formed, they're formed not just in policy, they're formations of economy, of a way to consolidate power and to put at bay resistance. And Obama is the face of that, whether we're talking about the military industrial complex or the nonprofit industrial complex or the academic industrial complex or the prisons. You know, that Obama is the face of protecting all of these interests. And so, you know, just say a few more things about Iraq and Afghanistan. There's a quote that I got from a book by Iqbal Ahmad, who's a decent scholar around the question, who was a Pakistani scholar around the question of Iraq, Afghanistan, and just the whole Middle East. He says, in an interview with somebody, an Afghan person, he says that it's not possible to play this game without sponsors. It involves great expenses, prizes and payments. It's a game that only the rich can afford to sponsor. No sponsor, no game. It is a game of dependency. This is how this war is. We're being torn to pieces by teams sponsored by outsiders. As much as the masses of Afghan people are fighting people, you know, they're living in sheer terror. I mean, they're fighting a defensive war, not an offensive war. They're not fighting because they just like to fight. They're fighting for their lives, to survive, for their cattle. That's the only way that they can have and live. And so you have the U.S. sponsoring, whether you're talking about Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or whoever is the new superstar of U.S., you know, opportunism, you know, that's there in the region, that is taking advantage of the people. They're protecting those interests. The same with Iraq. The same throughout Afghanistan is no different from Somalia. You know, the story there, the ungovernable state, supposedly, those, you know, unruly, savage people that just won't accept our treaties and our ways and our games. You know, this is how they portray the Afghan people. It's no different from the African world in many ways.
Uhuru, and that is Chioma Oru speaking at the African People's Solidarity Day event that took place on October 11th here in St. Petersburg, Florida. You're listening to Solidarity Not Charity, the program hosted by the African People's Solidarity Committee here on uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution. Hope that you have been enjoying that very informative presentation by Chioma Oru, who is the chairwoman of the North American Regional Committee for the African Socialist International, who is also a very central figure involved in the organizing of the Black is Back Coalition that's doing a anti-war march in Washington, D.C. on November 7th. Buses are coming from around the country to that march. I know they're going. I know there's a bus going from here, from Florida, from cities around the country, and you should be there November 7th to take a stand against Obama's wars in the U.S. and around the world. And that's going to be a really important march on November 7th in Washington, D.C. I want to draw your attention to some excellent articles that are up on Uhuru News right now. One of them is talking about the impending launch of the African People's Socialist Party in Sierra Leone, and that is a historic and momentous occasion that will be taking place next month in Sierra Leone, and you can read about that on uhurunews.com. Also, a couple of official communiques from the Uhuru movement. One is Chairman O'Malley's summation of the status of the and significance of the building of the Black is Back Coalition. So a really good update from the chairman on the building of the Black is Back Coalition. And another, and we want to send our condolences and our heartfelt thoughts to Comrade Chibaka Nombatha, whose wife and a strong comrade in the Uhuru movement, Sela Nombatha, passed away on October 4th. And we want to send out our thoughts and our great appreciation for that comrade and her tremendous contribution to the struggle of the African liberation movement. And I also want to let you know about a couple of upcoming events that are taking place. If you're in the Houston area today on, October 18th, you can hear O'Malley Shatella, chairman of the African Socialist International, speaking in Houston at a forum entitled The Black Struggle in the Era of Obama. He's going to be talking at the SHAPE Community Center at 3815 Live Oak in Houston, Texas. And that will be a great opportunity to hear the chairman speaking. And upcoming on Tuesday, October 20th is going to be the African People's Solidarity Day program in Oakland, California. That's going to take place at the Humanist Hall at 390 27th Street in Oakland, California. Don't miss that. That's from 6 to 9:30 in the evening. A $15 to $25 donation includes a light dinner. And Chairman O'Malley Shatella is going to speak there along with Chairwoman Penny Hess of the African People's Solidarity Committee and Shonrika Turney, who is a leader in the International People's Democratic Uhuru movement there in Oakland, where they've been making really important struggles in defense of the democratic rights of the African community. And the theme for African People's Solidarity Day this year is to stop U.S., the demand to stop U.S. colonial wars at home and abroad. And that's going to be a really excellent program there. For more information in the Oakland area, you can call 510-625-1106. So coming up next on Uhuru Radio, if you're listening live on the Sunday broadcast, you're going to hear a replay of O'Malley Shatella Speaks, which also was a recording made at this year's African People's Solidarity Day event on October 11th here in St. Petersburg, Florida at the Studio 620. And fantastic presentation by the chairman. And so that's coming up next. Following that, there will be a couple of more replays. And if you're listening on a day other than Sunday, if you want to know what's coming up next, you need to check the schedule page on uhururadio.com. Basically, there's a replay, a rerun rotation that takes place throughout the week when the live programming is not happening. But there's excellent programming coming up later today on uhururadio.com. You're going to have the replay of O'Malley Shatella Speaks, then also another replay of Rendezvous avec Chairman O'Malley, which is a French interview conducted out of London, England, with the chairman and translated from English into French. and then a replay of Uhuru Time, which is the Uhuru Radio's live program out of South Africa. And following that, live broadcast of The Church in Revolution, followed by African Women in Revolution. So lots of more great programming here on uhururadio.com. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned to uhururadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.